Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we have the privilege of tapping with regularity, both here at Secure Freedom Radio and at the Center for Security Policy, where he serves as one of our distinguished senior fellows, is Robert Spencer. He is the director of Jihad Watch, project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He is a columnist for PJ Media and Front Page Magazine. He is an essayist of great renown and the author of some 23 books. He is one of our favorite guests, and we're always privileged to catch up with him, especially today. Robert Spencer, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Frank. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you. You had an interesting piece that reminds us of a truth that I believe continues to elude the Biden administration, namely that the Islamic Republic of Iran is a mortal enemy of our country. Talk to us about the passing the hands of President Donald Trump of Qasem Soleimani and what the Iranian government is saying today about its determination to get revenge for his liquidation.
Qasem Soleimani, Frank, was the head of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. And in that capacity, he was responsible for numerous attacks on American troops in Iraq. And when he was killed, he was just arriving in Baghdad in order, reportedly, to coordinate a hostage-taking situation at the American embassy in Baghdad and attacks against further attacks against American troops. So it was also noteworthy that he was involved in the previous attacks on American troops in Iraq that were just a few weeks before he was killed and the reason why he was killed. But the Iranian regime is making him out to be a great martyr for truth and justice and an innocent victim of the great Satan and vowing all manner of revenge, including revenge within the United States. Unfortunately, this boast and threat is entirely plausible given the fact that several Iranians this year already, in 2021, have been apprehended crossing into the United States across our virtually defenseless southern border, and that many others have been captured in the past. Also, of course, there are numerous sympathizers of the Iranian regime and people who believe that America is indeed evil and needs to be destroyed within the United States already. So it's entirely plausible that they could make good on this threat.
My point in raising it, Robert, is this would be the same Iranian regime, would it not, that the administration seems determined to fashion some sort of new deal that ostensibly would restrain their nuclear ambitions. It seems hard to believe that we're simultaneously being told by the mullahs that they will kill us here at home in revenge for Soleimani's demise, and somehow be good partners for us in this nuclear enterprise. Am I missing something?
No, that's it. It's an absolutely absurd, ridiculous situation. And it's brought about by the willful ignorance of the Biden administration in persisting in assuming that they can deal with Iran in a way that will be beneficial for both parties and bring about peace, when Iran has been nothing except belligerent and aggressive against the United States. And they obviously see these overtures as a sign of weakness and to be taken advantage of. And that's how they are behaving now.
One of the things that I prize about your deep knowledge concerning the traditions of Islam and the culture that is so profoundly shaped by it, is how you can tell us perceptions of weakness are generally regarded by those imbued, Sharia supremacism, for want of a better term.
Well, you know, Frank, you can see it in the way that Iran behaved during the Obama administration, and then the Trump administration, and now again in the Biden administration. During the Obama administration, of course, there was the notorious incident where American troops were seized, American sailors rather, were seized by the Iranian authorities and paraded around as if they were prisoners of war, humiliated in front of the world. Now, this was something that the Iranians did with no hesitation and with great relish during the Obama administration, and that was no accident. This was because of the Obama administration's overtures to the Iranian regime that and concessions to the Iranian regime, the notorious pallets of cash and all the rest of it. And it made it appear to the Iranians as if they could virtually do anything to the Americans and there would be no consequences. This was very likely the case, and it's the same thing now. Whereas in the during the Trump administration, there was no such incident, and there were no provocations against American ships. They immediately resumed when Joe Biden became president, and that's no accident.
No accident, indeed. And again, I think it simply bespeaks a lack of, well, realism, to put it charitably. Sanity, to put it a little less so, that we're witnessing people who, let's be honest, should have learned a very bitter lesson from their dealings with the Iranians in the Obama administration, when many of them were involved in negotiations of the so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And yet, here they are not only repeating the kind of supine behavior, the appalling willingness to, in the most ignominious fashion imaginable, seek permission of the Iranians to have a deal. And they're doing it again. Again, I think the Soleimani episode just is such a powerful reminder that this is reckless in the extreme. And I think, of course, correction is long overdue. If this doesn't do it, I'm not quite sure what will, but I'm hopeful with your analysis and clarity on the subject, Robert Spencer, that we will see the administration changing course. A further reminder of the folly of ignoring the true character of Sharia supremacism comes to us from Afghanistan. And you had a piece at jihadwatch.org, in which you reported, as our friend Sam Faddis and I discussed yesterday, the announcement by the Taliban, which has now been not only greatly emboldened, but greatly empowered by the Biden team, that they were going to create a cohort of suicide bombers as part of a massive buildup of their military, presumably to make use of all of those weapons we left with them. But some of these, apparently, according to this report, 2,000 of them would be placed at the U.S. Embassy in Washington, D.C. What's up with that, Robert? For heaven's sakes.
Well, Frank, it's a wild story, but there's so many like it nowadays. This came from Taliban's defense minister, Malvi Mohammed Yaqub Mujahid, and he was responding to a report that the United States was going to deploy 2,000 soldiers to guard our embassy in Kabul, which I think under the circumstances would be entirely justified, if not closing that embassy altogether. But in any case, in response, Malvi Mohammed Yaqub Mujahid, the Taliban defense minister, said that if America wants 2,000 American troops, he actually said English troops, but he meant ours, at its embassy in Afghanistan, we also want 2,000 Fedayeen Mujahideen, that is, suicide bombers, from the Fateh force at the embassy of Afghanistan in America. And of course, it's very likely, as a matter of fact, that the Taliban could recruit, if not 2,000, at least a significant number of suicide bombers, as this is something that is given the promise of paradise in the Quran, that paradise is guaranteed to those who kill and are killed for Allah, according to the Quran, chapter 9, verse 111. And as a result, there are many young men who, unfortunately, who were all too happy to take that promise to heart and to act upon it. This is something that really could materialize as a security threat in the American embassy, because, of course, you have people coming over on diplomatic passports. The scrutiny is very slight in their regard and likely would continue to be because of the Biden administration's unwillingness to offend and desire to build bridges and all that. Consequently, it really is possible that you could end up with suicide bombers at the U.S. Embassy.
Here in Washington, D.C. Robert, bridge building, of course, is a favored metaphor for the Muslim Brotherhood in particular, when it talks about how we need to find common ground and develop relations with these Sharia supremacists, if not the Taliban necessarily, certainly those of the Muslim Brotherhood stripe. Remind us of the provenance of this analogy, if you would. Sayyid Qutb, I think, was the author of a book called Milestones, in which it appeared prominently. Give us the context, if you would, for bridge building as it's used by these guys.
Qutb was very clear that the bridge is a one-way bridge, that the idea of outreach, talks, dialogue, negotiations with non-Muslim entities was not in order to create some lasting accord, but to bring ultimately those non-Muslims into Islam. This is something that I think has been pursued quite skillfully by Islamic groups in all kinds of contexts, most notably interreligious Muslim-Christian dialogue between the Christian leaders and Muslim leaders. But the Christian leaders, as well as Western political leaders, seem to have no awareness of Qutb's explanation of what the bridge building was for in the first place, and no wariness or carefulness in their dialogue and negotiations, understanding that this is really all about bringing people another form of proselytizing rather than a genuine give and take.
Well, and another vehicle for submission of the non-Muslims to the Muslims, I think, is kind of the point, isn't it? That's where this whole jihad thing takes you. Robert, one of the other things that I prize about jihadwatch.org and our visits with you is kind of your running updates, this problem of failing to understand the true nature of not all Muslims, but the Muslims who embrace Sharia and who believe they must be guided by it and seek to fulfill what it prescribes as the divinely ordained end state, namely a global caliphate. And there are two stories on your site, as I'm looking at it now, that caught my eye about the United Kingdom. One about the authorities' response to a, well, expressly devoted jihadist. The other, a Muslim cleric and his admonitions to a woman, clearly Muslim woman, and how she should behave in response to a rape by a Muslim. Just give us a flavor of what these two stories tell us about what is happening inside one of our most important allies and exemplars of Western civilization.
Well, the British established a few years back Sharia courts that were supposed to be essentially private arbitration courts that would allow Sharia to be applied in matters of matrimony and related issues that were purely personal. And the pledge was that there would be no Sharia application in areas that overlapped with British law. And so, for example, spousal abuse cases where in Sharia, that's something that's perfectly justified, those cases would supposedly be referred to the secular courts. That did not happen. And it came out several years ago that particularly in those spousal abuse cases, the Sharia courts were operating according to Sharia and ignoring the British law, and ignoring information about how people who, and ignoring guidelines rather, about how people who commit this kind of abuse should be prosecuted or at very least investigated, and just telling the women to go back home and try to please their husbands all the more. This created a bit of a scandal in Britain, but nothing was actually done to rein in the Sharia courts. And so now there has been actually an Ahmadiyya Muslim cleric, which is kind of interesting since the Ahmadiyya are often presented as being the peaceful Muslims who abjure all the conflict that the other sects create. In any case, Mirza Masmour Ahmad, who is an Ahmadi Muslim leader in the UK, he was recently consulted by a woman who was raped, and he warned her not to go to authorities and told her that if she didn't have four witnesses, she wouldn't be able to establish the case because Islamic law, actually, based on the Quran, chapter 24, verse 4 and 24, verse 13, requires that for any kind of crime involving illicit sexual intercourse, four witnesses had to be presented. And if she didn't have that, then she had no case. So this is another instance in which Sharia is being applied at the expense of the secular law to which all the citizens of Britain should be subject.
Well, at the expense, more to the point, of a woman who has rights under that secular law and doesn't so much under Sharia. And this accommodation to Sharia law in these courts is a telltale sign of the end of Western civilization, it seems to me, inevitably, if not in the near future, certainly over time. And there are persistent efforts to bring such courts here in the United States as well. There's been efforts to counter that, notably in state-level legislation that I'm pleased to say the Center for Security Policy has strongly supported, called American Laws for American Courts, which essentially says we have one constitution, it is the supreme law of the land, and there shall not be these other courts dispensing some other laws. To the same point, Robert Spencer, of periling people's rights and freedoms, jeopardizing more generally our society, I believe. Thank you for your important insights into all of this, Robert, and for the clarity that you bring day upon day at jihadwatch.org. I commend all of our listeners to it, as well as to your frequent columns in places like PJ Media, Front Page Magazine. So thank you for joining us today, and come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we will speak with Todd Bensman about the problem of illegal immigration and what it's doing to morph our society as well, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The New York Times reported yesterday that, quote, breakouts and lockdowns in Chinese cities make a risk-free Olympics look unlikely, unquote. The obvious advice for American Olympians should be, don't go there. In a clear sign that the Chinese Communist Party is indifferent to international athletes' well-being, however, it is insisting that there will be no delay in next month's Winter Games in Beijing. And so far, the International Olympic Committee and the Games' corporate sponsors are submitting to the CCP's bullying. There is no chance that a government unconcerned about Olympian safety will behave better once they are in Beijing. In addition to exposing them to untold health risks, the communist regime will use quarantines to disadvantage non-Chinese competitors. And how soon will they be able to return home from a likely super-spreader event? Help save our Olympic athletes at genocidegames.org. This is Frank Affney.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we're joined by Todd Benzman. He is one of the country's preeminent experts on immigration policy, and particularly our insecure border. Brings to his present post as a senior national security fellow at the indispensable Center for Immigration Studies, a wealth of experience as an investigative journalist, as intelligence analyst with Texas Department of Public Safety, and of course as an author, both of countless essays and reports, but also of a terrific book, America's Covert Border War, The Untold Story of the Nation's Battle to Prevent Jihadist Infiltration. Todd Benzman, it's great to have you with us, sir. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks, Frank.
Todd, I want to talk to you sort of about the macro problem, but just keying off of the title of your book, you have been following closely a story unfolding about a Yemeni national wanted by the FBI for terrorism reasons that has gone missing, apparently, somewhere after he got away from the Mexicans. Give us his story, and then we'll back the lens up and talk about the sort of bigger picture that we should also be concerned about.
Sure. Well, everything that I know, most everything that I know about this case comes from a leaked Be on the Lookout for, it's called a BOLO, put out by the CBP to intelligence officials up and down the border for a Yemeni 21 years old, who the Mexicans apprehended, who was on the FBI's terrorism watch list. They apprehended him first in April of 2021 and deported him, which is the normal thing that is done in conjunction with the American FBI that works in country. But the deportation went awry, and he returned, made his way back to Piedras Negras, Mexico, which is right on the border across from Eagle Pass, Texas, and was apprehended again by the Mexicans in July. They held on to him for about 4 months, and of course, during those 4 months was the Del Rio migrant camp and just a lot of very heavy traffic through Mexico, a lot of chaos and confusion with the border crisis on both sides. And in that melee, the Mexicans released him with an order to voluntarily report in once a week to Mexican immigration, which is absurd because, of course, he disappeared and was expected to be trying to cross the southern border into Texas. So that's how the BOLO went out. That BOLO went out in December. I do not know if he was caught or if they've caught them. I have been unable to ascertain that. But the bigger picture here is that this is indicative of a major failure in collaboration on security between the Mexicans and the Americans, which I attribute to the fact that both sides of the border are in utter chaos, that the mass migration crisis caused this failure. There's one other small piece of information that I'll offer to you that I have not yet written about, which is that an intelligence official that I work with, who's in country and has direct knowledge of the situation, said that when the Mexicans deported him, they had an officer fly with him to a European country, probably a transit country like Frankfurt or France. I couldn't get the which country it was. And instead of finishing the trip, that Mexican officer came home and left him on his own, and he just left the flight and disappeared. That's how he got away and came back. All of that is just a completely unacceptable set of circumstances that never should have been allowed to happen. Hopefully that this guy doesn't turn up in a bad way with some violence or something in the United States. If that happens, all of these facts will suddenly become very, very important. But they should be important now, even before something terrible happens.
Indeed. And the trouble is that as you say, this catch and report or catch and release, effectively, policy has been proven unworkable on our side of the border. Why anyone would think it's going to prove more viable in Mexico, it just boggles my mind. But the point is that the combination of the two, as you've indicated, is exacerbating the porousness of our border, the attractiveness of that porous border to both people simply seeking improved conditions for them and their children, and people willing to make the trip for the purposes of doing us harm. It's infuriating that we're seeing this persist. And I wanted to ask you, as a former Texas Department of Public Safety intelligence analyst, as well as a guy closely following what's happening in your state of Texas and across the border, we hear a lot about the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, making efforts to secure the border with both, you know, the Texas Rangers and National Guard, and actually building the fence, the border wall that was left only partly complete by Donald Trump and not finished by his successor. What's the state of play in Texas at the moment? Is any of that really materializing, Todd Bensman, and making a difference or not?
Well, the numbers at this point for December look like they're going to be about 175,000 apprehensions and another 48,000 gotaways. So we're looking in the, you know, low 200,000s again for just a month, 500,000 apprehensions in just the first 3 months of the fiscal year. So the numbers are still just out of, you know, all record books. It's just insane out there. You can go down there and see it in live time, the chaos. So I think that the governor's initiatives may be doing some good in the limited areas where they're unfolding, but if they're really going to have any kind of impact, they need to expand the state fence to the rest of the border if they can, and to have their criminal trespass prosecution program expanded. They're just essentially pilot programs at this point in the Del Rio, kind of the Val Verde County and Kinney County of Texas. So, I mean, it's a start, but I don't really see it having much effect at this point. Not yet, but it could over time.
Well, the question is time on our side? And we're going to be talking with Hans von Spakovsky momentarily about the prospect that, as in New York City at the moment, illegal aliens coming here, as you've documented, Todd, by the millions, are going to turn into, in the near future, perhaps, voters. Permanently alter the electorate of this country and inevitably the politics of it as well. Let me ask you, though, before we let you go, Todd, you have been very mindful, it seems to me, of the degree to which people in our government are intent on making permanent these kinds of arrangements, these kinds of, fundamental transformation is the term that Barack Obama used, of our immigration policies and border security, in part through reforming, as they call it, the law, or by getting amnesty to millions and millions and millions. We're not even clear really how many millions of people who've come to this country illegally already. But as you've discussed with me in past conversations, Todd, inevitably the prospect of such reforms, especially amnesty, translates into an intensification of the tractor beam drawing illegal aliens here. What is the state of play with respect to efforts to effect such reforms and enact amnesty in this country? And is there anything that can be done to prevent that from happening, which would be, to my way of thinking, disastrous?
Well, the driven by the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which is where a lot of this is coming from. Kind of think Bernie Sanders rallies during the 2016 campaign and the 2020 campaign, right? They were big. Those are the people that are in power now and have great influence over immigration policy. And they are relentless in attempting to attach to unrelated bills, right, you know, budget reconciliation bills and budget bills and whatever they can, these reforms that you're talking about, which would fundamentally transform the country and legalize millions and millions of people, enticing millions more to come and get it. The only thing, I mean, it has just been a razor's edge. I mean, so close all the time as the Senate parliamentarian who has, you know, been able to excise those things out kind of in the nick of time before votes. I don't think that we could expect any lessening of that, of those attempts to keep trying in every way possible to open the borders permanently and legislatively. So 2022, the midterms are going to be very, very important for Republicans or really anybody, independents, anybody who's interested in having control over a border, of not ceding control of the border to foreigners who want to come in. That's just where it's, where the rubber's going to meet the road, so to speak, right there to start with. And then, of course, there's 2024. But remember that, you know, Congress is the first place to start to kind of put an end to that sort of thing, that these just razor edge close calls that just keep happening and happening. And there's a whole more year of that to go, or maybe a little bit less, at least. But the executive branch is what is the branch that really has the lever on the gate. So that is going to be the key one in 2024 if the country is ever going to put a stop to this totally historic first time ever mass migration event.
But again, Todd, to anticipate our conversation with Hans, I'd welcome your thoughts on this too. If we don't see this changed, if we do, in fact, worse yet, see, in addition to continuing surges of illegal aliens coming across the border, more and more of them beyond New York City, perhaps, given the right to vote, chances are we're not going to see this electoral change that you're talking about that would presumably prove at least an opportunity to have a course correction on both the immigration and certainly on this, granting of the vote to these folks.
I think you're right. You're totally right. I mean, this is a very, very dangerous, slippery slope to start allowing illegal or just people who are non-citizens to vote in local elections. I think that you start there and then you expand that as much as you can. They're going to vote Democrat. That's why they want this. I would foresee a lot of litigation. I would hope for a lot of litigation. That has to stop. That can't be allowed to go. Every single one of those has to be battled to the bitter end. And I hope that there are forces arraying to do that battle.
We're going to be talking with Hans shortly about this, as I say, and we'll get a better feeling from him. But when you hear what Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are talking about in terms of dispensing with the filibuster and enacting by a very, very narrow margin election laws, voting rights legislation, as they euphemistically describe it, that will essentially institutionalize some of these arrangements that have perpetrated fraud in the past and that especially if compounded by these newly minted non-citizen voters, will be the death of, free and fair elections for one thing, but I think of a competitive political system as well. It will reduce us, I fear, to a one-party state. Todd, that has implications, of course, for a lot more than just our border insecurity and our immigration challenges specifically, but we know that those are top of mind and the major focus of your efforts. And your reporting on this, my friend, is incalculably important, and we appreciate your visits when you have a chance to do it with updates. I know you're headed to Mexico next couple of days, and I hope once you're returned, we can get an update on the evolving situation there as well. So safe travels in the meantime.
Happy to do it. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for bringing attention to this. Thanks.
Well, and you too. We'll do it more together when you return. Next up, we will speak with Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation about election reform and whether it will deform our elections going forward. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm always delighted to be able to say we are joined by Hans von Spakovsky, a man we simply refer to here as HVS. He is one of our country's duty experts on the matter of election integrity, not just from an academic or think tank role, though he is a very prominent figure at the Heritage Foundation, but as a practitioner as well. He has been a member of the Federal Election Commission. He's also served in senior positions at the Department of Justice with respect to, among other things, voting rights. He is one of our real resources here. We're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him, especially on a momentous day when the President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States are both campaigning in Georgia to try to get the Senate to jettison the filibuster and enact by the narrowest of margins sweeping changes to our election laws that will, well, I fear, mark the end of our free and fair elections in this country. We're going to talk with Hans about all of that and more. Hans, it's great to have you back in the house virtually. Welcome, sir. Happy New Year to you.
Well, thanks for having me, and Happy New Year.
Not sure that there's much reason to believe it will be, but in particular in this space, but we want your thoughts on all of that. But before we turn to it, Hans, I wanted to ask you about something we discussed in connection with what is happening at our borders with our previous guest, Todd Bensman, in which he warned that the numbers are continuing to swell. The total numbers that made it across, I think, probably are close to 2 million last year, and that's without factoring in the getaways. But all of this takes on a even more grave concern when it turns out that in places like New York City, and I'm sure soon elsewhere, they're going to be turned into voters, at least in local elections and presumably and federal ones as well. Walk us through what on earth is going on with all of that and its implications.
Well, in fact, I think that's one of the major reasons for the open borders policy at southern border. I mean, it's not just that for 20 years now, the progressive left has been trying to extinguish the line between aliens and citizens and say that as soon as an alien is here, they should have all the rights and privileges of a citizen. But I think they're deliberately doing that because they view it as a way of getting in voters who will vote for them and keep them in power. And I think that is behind what is going on.
I guess the thing that is stunning is not so much that that's been their ambition for some time or that it may have motivated them to throw open the gates to illegal immigration, but how rapidly it seems they're now moving to translate all of that into actual votes. And not just presumably, as I say, in New York City, but elsewhere as well. What do you make of that?
Well, they are, in, like I said, they are intent on making sure that aliens are able to vote. And while the most visible sign of it is the local city ordinance that was just signed into law in New York, which says that aliens will be able to vote in local elections. Look, this is, as I said, this is a long-term goal of the progressive left. And this is illustrated by the fact that every time states such as Kansas, for example, Arizona, Georgia, actually, have tried to put in new regulations or provisions that would require verification of citizenship of individuals who are registered to vote, they have been sued by the left to prevent that. And I testified at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing late last year on one of these big federal voting bills. And Ted Cruz got into it with one of the liberal witnesses who was saying that Texas's election reform bill that was passed into law last year was discriminatory. And when Cruz asked him, well, what, tell me one thing you're complaining about, you know what his complaint was, Frank? His complaint was over the fact that the new election reform law in Texas required the Secretary of State to on a monthly basis check with the DMV to find individuals who, when they went and got their driver's license, provided information that they were not U.S. citizens. That's what he was complaining about.
Which brings me to one of those past machinations, motor voter proceeding. Yeah. How has that worked out in practice? Has that contributed to people who do not have a right to vote, nonetheless having the ability to do so?
Yeah. And a graphic example that was given just a couple of years ago in Pennsylvania, when the Secretary of State was forced to resign after it became public, that because of a glitch in the DMV system, over 10,000 aliens had gotten registered to vote when they went to get their driver's license. And this had been going on for years without state officials realizing that this was occurring.
Doesn't sound like a glitch to me. It sounds like that's what was baked into the idea, right? Which brings us to what the Democrats are up to at the moment, Hans. The president and vice president, as I mentioned, are both in Georgia today talking about the imperative need to beat back various efforts that have been made by principally Republican-dominated state legislative chambers to, well, deny people the vote, is how it's being cast. Talk about what's been happening in those state legislatures, and is that the practical effect of it, or is it really very different from that, and something that should be lauded rather than opposed and countermanded at the federal level?
No, it should be lauded. And Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer and others apparently are following the old adage that if you tell a lie often enough, people will start believing it. Those states like Georgia, for example, they haven't made it harder to vote. In fact, they have better laws than, for example, Chuck Schumer's home state of New York. What they're doing is they're trying to protect the vote. And again, if Biden wants to complain about things, he should go to his home state. Because, for example, Georgia for years has had early voting to give people more of an opportunity to vote. In fact, there are 18 days of early voting in Georgia. There are 14 days of early voting in Texas, which also passed a big election reform bill that Biden has complained about. Delaware, until this year, has never had early voting. For the first time, they are going to have early voting in elections this year, but only 8 days. I mean, not only that, but, contrast Chuck Schumer from New York, who's also been complaining about Georgia and its horrible laws because they actually, for example, require an ID to vote, which New York does not. Well, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, in the last three federal elections, 2016, 2018, and 2020, a higher percentage of citizens turned out to vote in Georgia than in New York. Not only that, but Georgia, with its voter ID law, again, contrasting New York with no ID law, black residents of Georgia turned out at a higher rate to vote in Georgia in the 2018 and 2020 elections than in New York. So clearly, there's just simply not a problem with what Georgia and states like Texas are doing.
And yet, we are seeing Chuck Schumer, the majority leader of the United States Senate, collaborating with Nancy Pelosi and, of course, the Biden administration to enact sweeping changes to our election laws, the most important of which, I guess, is essentially putting the federal government in the business of dictating to the states how they are going to run their elections, which the last time I checked was contrary to the Constitution of the United States. Hans, you're a distinguished lawyer and election specialist. Am I right about that? And if so, what's the excuse for this kind of rewrite?
Well, their no, you're right. But their excuse is, like I said, this false claim that they're peddling. I mean, it's basically a propaganda war, that there's voter suppression going on, when we know from the turnout numbers that that is just simply not true. These federal bills, and there's more than one, in essence, Chuck Schumer and others, like James Clyburn said this just the other day, they don't trust the states and the voters of the states to do the right thing. So they've got to dictate it from Washington. And what's amazing about Chuck Schumer, for example, is that, look, one of the bills that they're pushing would require every single state to put in same-day voter registration and to put in no-fault absentee voting, so you don't need an excuse to vote.
To dispense with voter ID, as I understand it, as
yes,
well.
Is that yes. Right? But those two items, same-day voter registration and no-fault absentee, there were actually referenda on the ballot in New York in November, Chuck Schumer's home state, to do that. And the voters of New York voted them down. They did not want those changes. And yet here Chuck Schumer is trying to push a federal bill that would override the voters of his own home state.
This brings me to the last topic with you. As we're trying to take stock of what the administration is doing with its congressional allies, notably Chuck Schumer. One issue that has arisen, thanks to some good reporting by John Solomon's Just the News yesterday, Hans von Spakovsky, is the track record of Democrats in these states where they have been very actively involved in clearly moving to make these elections less likely to be, as I say, free or fair. There's a fellow by the name of Mark Elias, who I know you have encountered often over the years, who has been, among other places, in Georgia in the previous election cycle, championing some of the provisions that would make these elections at the state level or federal elections conducted by the states far less resistant to fraud. He has four pillars, in fact, that he has been promoting, one of which is essentially allowing ballot harvesting, for heaven's sakes. Give us just a sense of Elias's role in all of this, his track record. And when one is told, trust us, we're going to have the federal government imposing new statutes regarding election reform and voting rights, as they say, that they're actually going to make things vastly worse in terms of election integrity, not better.
Well, that's exactly what Elias has been trying to do. Look, he is the legal general of the left. He has made a huge amount of money from both the Democratic Party, Democratic candidates, and from all these supposedly nonprofit organizations that give him money. And he has been behind almost every lawsuit trying to get rid of everything from voter ID laws to witness requirements on absentee ballots, trying to stop signature comparison absentee ballots, and trying to push every state to be forced to allow vote harvesting. Les calls it vote harvesting. I call it vote trafficking. It tells you a lot about them. And by the way, this is in the federal bill Schumer is pushing, that they are trying to force states to allow paid political operatives to be able to pick up absentee ballots from people's homes. What does that tell you about them?
What could possibly go wrong, Hans?
Yeah, yeah. They're not interested in the integrity of the vote. They're not interested in protecting voters. They want their paid political people to be able to go to people's homes, pressure, coerce them, and collect their ballot. That is more important to them than the integrity of the election process. That's why it's in their federal bill that they're pushing. That's why it's been in lawsuits they have filed. He fought that all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mark Elias did when Arizona legislators very smartly banned vote trafficking by third-party strangers like political consultants. And he sued saying that was discriminatory, went all the way to U.S. Supreme Court, fortunately lost. But that tells you everything you need to know about Mark Elias.
And more to the point about these various pieces of legislation. On the one hand, and this is a generalization, I grant you, but on the one hand, you've had Republican legislatures trying to assure the integrity of elections, and in ways that I think, as you just suggested, Hans, are broadly supported by the American people. Notably, voter ID, I think, is overwhelmingly popular with the public, and they're horrified, rightly so, about these kinds of ideas like Chuck Schumer's for essentially cooking the book in the elections. But it brings me back to the point that we started with, Hans. If in fact you combine these kind of voting machinations and giving the vote to people who are not citizens of the United States, is there any doubt in your mind how these things turn out? Is it possible that it could be other than essentially a one-party state going forward with the Democrats permanently in charge?
Yeah, I mean, you're basically making it easy for anyone who wants to cheat to be able to cheat. You're imperiling honest elections for the foreseeable future in the United States.
Lastly, Hans, quickly, what are the chances that the New York City Code is going to be successfully challenged in court and struck down?
I actually think, as long as they get a good judge, which these days is a risk, I actually think they will be able to knock it down. And in fact, a lawsuit was literally just filed by the, I think it's the chairman of the New York GOP. And they have a very good case because there's a provision in the New York state constitution that says that in order to be eligible to vote in the state, you have to be a citizen. And while New York may argue it only applies to statewide elections, I think that provision applies to all elections in the state, whether it's statewide or local.
Presumably, that would be the state's position, too. But it will be very interesting to see whether the Democratic governor of New York will be entering the traces with the Republicans or in opposition to them. You will be following it closely, I know, Hans von Spakovsky, and we count on you to share with us your insights as you do so generously on this program and, of course, in myriad other outlets. We so appreciate your work at the Heritage Foundation and that public service you've rendered in the past, and I hope you will again in the future. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Thank you very much for joining us. Thanks to all the rest of you for doing the same. I hope you do so again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.